Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Crimes against humanity did not end with the Nuremberg trials. Over the decades since, millions have died as a result of such crimes in Europe, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. A local university professor has been working for almost a decade now to forge a global treaty for the prevention and punishment of crimes against humanity. Dr. Leila Sadat is the James Carr Professor of International Criminal Law and director of the Whitney R. Harris World Law Institute at Washington University's School of Law. She joins me in studio to talk about her effort, which now includes a film on the subject. It is titled Never Again, Forging a Convention for Crimes Against Humanity. Nice to have you back with us again.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure.
This has been quite an undertaking for you. We'll talk about the film in a moment, which I know was quite an undertaking. But this has been going on for 8 or 9 years, this initiative of yours. That's quite an undertaking.
Yes. I think it's one of the kinds of projects that if you knew how hard it would be, you probably would never start it. But it seemed very, very important. And so when I began it with a little trepidation, I really resolved to see it through.
Why has it taken so long to get to where you are?
Well, what's interesting to me is that for me, the idea was absolutely obvious. We were missing an integral piece of the international legal puzzle. The Harris Institute, for a variety of reasons, really had some good contacts that could help draft that piece, including a deep connection with Sharif Bassiouni, who just passed away, who drafted the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. Whitney Harris was still alive, former Nuremberg prosecutor, and he was very committed. And so this just seemed like such an obvious thing to do, but it was quite technically difficult. It had never been done before, even though almost 70 years had passed since Nuremberg. And there was just a lot of skepticism. So part of the difficulty was it took many, many meetings and conversations and articles and essays and a PowerPoint presentation and ultimately a film to convince people that this really was necessary.
What specifically do you want to come out of it?
Well, what we're really hoping is that the United Nations adopts a new global treaty on crimes against humanity. And what that treaty would do is it would tell states that ratify the treaty that they have to prevent and punish the perpetrators of crimes against humanity. States would be obligated not to commit them. Groups would be obligated not to commit them. And anybody who did commit them could be punished in a national court. And that states would cooperate with each other in bringing perpetrators to justice.
It would seem to me, however, that if someone was intent upon committing crimes of this nature, no treaty is going to stop.
Well, that's true. We have laws against murder in the United States. Sure. We still have murders. So law alone, of course, is never the panacea. But without law, you have chaos and you have obviously an increase in criminality. So you need the law and you also need the enforcement and you need to build mechanisms for prevention. And prevention is one of the trickiest pieces of the puzzle. You need to monitor situations. So you have kind of an early warning system. You need to train police and military officers because many of them commit these crimes out of an excess of zeal. And that actually can be controlled with better training and instructions. And you have to develop state capacity. So you're never going to prevent 100% of the crimes, but these are crimes on a mass scale. So if you can prevent even one conflict, you might save a million lives.
It seems to me, again, I'm just looking at it. I have not been involved for 8 or 9 years with it. But looking at it from my vantage point, it would seem that the emphasis would have to be more on punishment. The idea of prevention just seems to me, if you're lawless, you're going to break the law.
Mm. Yeah. That's a really great point. Mm. So when you look at situations in which these crimes have been committed, sometimes you will see that the individual presiding over either the state apparatus or the group apparatus perpetrating the crimes, they exhibit a truly pathological mentality, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Nothing's going to stop them.
Exactly.
But sometimes you actually have individuals that are doing this for calculated reasons and they can be influenced. It also sends quite a clear message when you start putting people in jail. And we haven't had a very long experience with that because we've only really been doing that since the 1990s and only for a few situations. There are also national prosecutions that have been brought, which have been very, very important. And sometimes you're putting people in jail not just as punishment, not as just as an act of retribution, but also because the victims are seeking justice. And it's very hard sometimes for a society to move forward, especially after a conflict, if the victims don't feel that they've been heard, that their cases have been adjudicated, that they've received justice.
Can we just look at the former Yugoslavia for a moment? What
sure.
went on there? That seemed very, very complicated. It took a long time to round up the bad guys, if you will. And I guess some of them are still out there that haven't been found. Could the Bosnian genocide have been prevented, do you think, under such a treaty?
Well, I'd like to maybe answer the question a little bit differently. There was already a genocide convention that addressed genocide and has an obligation of prevention and of punishment. So we know that the massacre at Srebrenica, which was qualified as a genocide by the Yugoslavia tribunal, wasn't prevented, in fact. And it wasn't prevented by the fact that the tribunal had been created already. And it wasn't prevented by the fact that the Dayton Accords were ongoing, right? We had a lot of things happening. At the same time, when you think of the NATO intervention in 1999, which was a response to what was seen as recidivism, basically by Milosevic, and the NATO intervention was undertaken at a time when the ICTY was not just getting started, which
ICTY
was true in
being
the Yugoslavia tribunal. And the prosecutor of the Yugoslavia tribunal writes to NATO and says, folks, you're under my jurisdiction. Don't commit war crimes. And if you actually look at the civilian casualties as a result of the NATO bombing campaign, which was an extensive campaign compared to any conflict we've seen today, it's incredibly low compared not just to things like Syria, right, where you have, again, a pathological behavior by a head of state, in my view. But compared to even the U.S. drone campaigns and the Iraq war that the United States and the U.K. were involved in, the casualty levels are extremely high. The NATO bombing campaign resulted in an estimated 250 to 500 deaths. And while that's not good, and many have criticized the campaign, the fact that there was an active war crimes tribunal working and telling NATO commanders you actually can't commit war crimes because you're under my jurisdiction, I think it made a huge difference, actually. And we can see that where you have a functioning international criminal court or functioning national justice systems, you can never prevent all the crimes, but the incidence is much lower.
We have an international criminal court. Last time I checked, the United States was not part of that, was it?
No.
Okay. We've got to be a player.
I totally agree with you. It's very sad to me. I actually was in Rome in 1998. Next year, the ICC statute will celebrate its 20th anniversary. It has 124 states parties. The United States signed the treaty. Under Secretary Bolton tried to withdraw the signature. You can't legally do that, but there's a letter that says the United States will not comply essentially with its obligations as a signatory. The Obama administration cooperated with the court, handing it defendants and supporting it in a variety of other ways. And in my view, this court should be actively supported by the United States. You know, international criminality is not in the interest of peaceful and democratic nations.
Why aren't we a part of it? What rationale is there for not being a part of something like this?
Well, there's fear. I think this is largely driven by fear, and it's somewhat driven by domestic politics. So fear of the possibility of the United States military being investigated, which can happen anyway, because if the U.S. military are active in a state that's an ICC state party, that state has jurisdiction and can give that jurisdiction to the ICC. So you really can't avoid it if you're going to be globally active. And the U.K. and France, which are very active militarily, understood that, and they've both ratified the statute. So that's part of the fear, and I think that's an education problem, I think. The domestic politics side of it is really tough because the ICC, like many, many international institutions, is just part of the, I don't even know what to call it, the attack on internationalization, on globalization, on international institutions. And that's a much tougher piece of the puzzle.
The United States clearly is very sensitive about giving other countries the authority to prosecute our military, for instance. It was a big issue in Iraq and trying to satisfy some of the diplomacy there. But looking at it from a legal point of view, isn't there some justification for that?
You mean justification for the U.S. concern?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, think of the example I just gave, right? Yeah. The Yugoslavia Tribunal was active. The U.S. was operating under its jurisdiction. There were no prosecutions of Americans for war crimes. The United States military abides by the laws of war. We have a code of military justice that we can use if there are war crimes committed. And if those crimes are committed and the U.S. investigates, that immediately deprives the International Criminal Court of jurisdiction. So that's why I say this is really a fear factor. Mm. I think the United States really cares about the laws of war. We've ratified the Geneva Conventions. I don't think there's much concern that we would deliberately have a policy to violate them. And if we investigate, we're immediately outside ICC jurisdiction. Mm. So I think that, again, is more of a fear than a reality. Mm. And the best way really to influence the court is to join it and elect a U.S. judge, mm-hmm. right? Wouldn't you be less scared if you had an American judge sitting there, if you had American personnel in the office of the prosecutor? Yep. I think the United States should be leading this court, not running away from it. But that's a tough political sell.
But particularly in the current political environment, it might be difficult to make that happen. What is the difference between crimes against humanity and genocide?
Oh, that's a great question. We try to answer it in our film. So basically, crimes against humanity is the big category and genocide is a subcategory. So crimes against humanity include murder, torture, deportation, crimes of sexual violence, disappearances, apartheid, persecution, arbitrary arrest and detention when they're committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack on civilians. Genocide is sort of like that, except you need a specific intent to destroy the group. So crimes against humanity is about protecting individuals, and genocide is about protecting groups. That's really the biggest conceptual difference.
So it could be both.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Holocaust being, I guess, an example of that.
Yes, and the Holocaust was actually charged as a crime against humanity at Nuremberg. Yeah. And the Genocide Convention later came to embody that group idea, but it left out all the other attacks against individuals. Yeah. And that's the gap we're trying to fill, because sometimes you just can't prove that the attack was designed to exterminate the group. It just happened to have resulted in 100,000 people being killed or 50,000 rapes, or really the scale of these crimes is enormous.
It's really hard to imagine that these things have taken place at all.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm talking with Leila Sadat from Washington University. We're talking about the work she's doing and has been doing for a good number of years now, trying to come up with a global treaty on crimes against humanity, prevention and punishment of these crimes. There have been so many over the years since the Holocaust. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on crimes against humanity. Leila, tell me something about the steering committee that has been working on this. How is it composed? Is there much of an international presence?
Yes. The initiative is entirely international, although obviously rooted here in St. Louis. So I'm the chair, and there are six other members from different continents of the world, actually. Richard Goldstone from South Africa, Juan Mendez, who's South American, Bill Shabas, who's European, as is Christine van der Mingert. Bill, I should say, is originally Canadian as mm-hmm. well. And Sharif Bassiouni, who's a world citizen, I would say, Egyptian and U.S. He recently, unfortunately, passed away. And then Undersecretary General Hans Corell is Swedish, and he was the number two diplomat at the United Nations during the negotiation of the Rome Statute. Mm-hmm.
Are you going to come up with a draft treaty? Is that the idea?
Well, we did actually. Yeah. We published a draft in 2010 after 3 years of work, and it's been translated into 8 languages, some by us and some by enthusiastic supporters along the way. So it's in all 6 United Nations languages plus Portuguese and German now. And what we did then is we published our draft and tried to promote it. And tried to get members of the international community to take it on board and take the ideas seriously. And that, of course, was in a way the most difficult part of the initiative. The first 3 phases, which were study and exploration and drafting, were highly technical. And so they presented the kind of legal challenge that's sort of fun for international lawyers, but is eminently doable because you have control of the project. That is published in a book by Cambridge University Press. And then the actually much more difficult task was to take it to the United Nations, to diplomats, civil society, judges, prosecutors, and say, okay, we have this great idea. You guys should really do this. And that turned out to be the last 7 years of work.
You know, I was under the impression that the United Nations had some rules and regulations on the books against this sort of thing anyway.
Well, it's clear that crimes against humanity is illegal under customary international law. It's also clear that it's illegal under the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. But the problem is that none of that requires national courts to prosecute the crimes. And most of the perpetrators escape international prosecution. So you have to catch them and prosecute them nationally. And that's because you just don't have enough capacity in the international system. So that's why we needed a new treaty.
So the key to this, I guess it's beginning to be clarified for me now. The key really is the national the national provision of this, to get the ball rolling in the in these states themselves.
Exactly. And just to give you an example, the United States doesn't have federal laws prohibiting the commission of crimes against humanity. So if somebody comes here as a refugee or an immigrant or from another country and has committed this crime, we actually can't prosecute it in the United States. So the Department of Homeland Security has estimated that there are at least 1,000, if not more, individuals who are currently living in the United States who may have perpetrated international crimes that can't be prosecuted. So what you're trying to do is get states to have federal legislation so that they can actually bring the cases, or if they don't want to bring the cases because it's the evidence is abroad, it's just not in their national interest, they would extradite the individual to a state with jurisdiction. And so you're trying to create this interlocking web of states that can try or extradite these individuals, just like we do for terrorism. Mm-hmm. We have the same kind of treaty arrangements for terrorism.
Do you have any sense from our government over the last years as to how responsive and receptive it is to what you're doing?
Well, I'm very excited to say that the U.S. government, even under the current administration, which was a little bit of a surprise, has been very welcoming of the initiative. I think there was initially some skepticism, but everybody was skeptical initially, except those of us who really could see how this could change the game. And the current administration, when so the treaty has now actually been picked up by the United Nations, and it's being worked on by something called the International Law Commission, which is the official treaty drafting body of the UN. They've come up with their own draft. And so it's now being debated every fall in what they call the 6th Committee of the UN, which is the legal committee. And the U.S. government issued a very positive statement. I mean, non-committal, but at least it wasn't negative, which is pretty big.
Well, what sort of a timetable are we looking at? I mean, this sounds like it's years down the road if it's approved at all by the UN.
I'm really hoping 2019 or 2020. It's actually on a fast track right now. One never knows what will happen. You know, lots of things could get in the way. What's been happening is each year as the International Law Commission has been taking bits and pieces of a new draft treaty to the UN, states have made comments. And so we've been tracking those comments for the last 4 years, and they're increasingly positive. So this year there were about 30 states that made comments. Only 2 were negative, and there were 2 you would expect to be.
Who were they?
Well, one was China. Well, China, you know, crimes against humanity focus on human rights campaigns against your own citizens if you're a state. And so China is very wary of interference in its sovereignty. That's kind of its leitmotif at the UN. Yeah. So one would not expect China to be positive. But many, many other states that one might think would be worried were not. And again, because this is about really engaging the national systems. This isn't about an international court grabbing your people and trying them. This is about national jurisdictions tightening up the rules.
But you've got to concede that some states are just not going to have anything to do with it. I mean, what do you do about a North Korea?
You know, in my view, you contain a state like North Korea and you wait patiently. And that's what we had to do with the Soviet Union. And nobody thought 1989 would happen. I mean, that was a miracle. I remember sitting in my office. I was practicing law in Paris when we got word that the Berlin Wall was coming down. And it was astonishing. Who had ever thought? And so I think, unfortunately, in this day of 24-hour news cycles, we're not very patient. But sometimes patience and the long game is what you need for a country like North Korea, which is paranoid, isolated, difficult, is committing crimes against its own people in large, large numbers, and of course, threatening its neighbors. And so with a state like that, you have to try to bring them into the international community, and you have to wait.
You know, it seems to me, when you say someone like China is out of the game essentially now, it just reinforces how complicated this is, because you're dealing with how many countries are there? 160 countries, something like that, whatever the number is. Different laws, different cultures, and certainly different attitudes just makes this an enormous challenge.
Yeah, it's kind of fun, though. You know, I mean, I like international law. There are 193 countries, actually.
I knew you'd know that.
So yes, it's hard. But, you know, every state in the world has actually ratified the Geneva Conventions on the laws of war. We have 100% ratification. Do we have 100% compliance? No. And that's true, as I said, with domestic laws, where you can see court orders that aren't obeyed and murder that's committed in spite of the law. But nonetheless, you do, with respect to these really core crimes, we're not talking about stealing somebody's pocket money here. We're talking about crimes that amount to genocidal acts, right? Crimes that involve mass rape, mass slaughter, attacking defenseless civilians, women and children. And so there's pretty much universal agreement that this is unlawful. But it is important to get states on the record to agree to that in a piece of paper that commits them, and they can be held accountable if they violate that.
What's ahead for you and your group now as you wait out some of these other entities that are going over this?
Well, as I said, we made a film because, again, we're trying to reach out to various groups to talk about why international law matters more generally, too. It's an educational film. It's about 45 minutes. We do side events all over the world. Actually, last year we were in Asia doing an event, bringing together experts, talking about the need for a treaty. This year we'll go to Latin America and to Africa. I'll be in New York in December doing an event. This is about building popular consensus. This is about getting states and the international community to agree, you know what, let's try to take a step forward. And it is a hard time to do that. There are a lot of crimes ongoing. The Syria conflict is just numbing, and the recent ethnic cleansing in Burma is distressing. But at the same time, you just can't give up. You've got to keep going.
Does what's going on in Burma, for instance, qualify as a crime against humanity?
Well, it certainly has all the indications, right? I have to be careful. I do work as the special advisor to the International Criminal Court prosecutor. So I would be cautious about making a legal determination. But if you think of the crimes that have been alleged, forcible transfer, even deportation, murder, burning villages, destroying, you know, sexual violence. It seems that we have all the hallmarks of the Commission of Crimes Against Humanity. It's an ethnic cleansing, essentially. And ethnic cleansing is a crime against humanity.
Yeah. A displacement. Yeah. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people have crossed that border or had to. I want to talk specifically about the film, but before time gets away, let's point out that the International Institute today is presenting Never Again, Forging a Convention for Crimes Against Humanity. That's at the International Institute. The film is going to be screened at 6 o'clock, as I understand it, Layla. Things get going a little bit earlier. People can register until 4 o'clock, as I understand. It's free. Always a word that we like to use here whenever possible. But you've got a couple of other things going that you want to tell people about. The Holocaust Museum event, for instance.
Right. Well, we were really honored. The film just showed this weekend as part of the Whitaker International Film Festival in St. Louis. It's going to be shown tonight at the International Institute. And on January 21st, it'll be shown at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum. It is free of charge. And if somebody really can't make any of those screenings but is very interested, they can just write to me at the law school and we'll send them a link for the film. And the only thing we ask is that people tell us that they watched it because we're interested to see how many people watch it and how many screenings we get. If they want to make a donation to the Institute, it's a charitable gift because Washington University, of course, is a 501c3. And we'd be happy to have their support.
The all of that information will be put on our website, by the way, by the middle of the afternoon. So
wonderful.
people can refer to it. But people can register for the International Institute event until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Well, I think that the conversation we had shortly before going on the air is illustrative of just how complicated all of this is. Tell me about the making of this film. Oh, before we get there, are you looking for international distribution or do you have it? Because you'll need that, I think, to convince people.
So I'm not a professional filmmaker, and I'm just a law professor. But what I have found is people love the film. And so all we have to do is show them a little clip, and they say, oh, can I have that? Can I distribute it? Can I watch it? So really, the film is getting very wide circulation by word of mouth right now. It's being passed around. I'm sure we could do even better, but we're sort of working on that. You know, that takes a substantial investment of resources, which is beyond what we can realistically do at the law school. In terms of making the film, you know, it was 3 years in the making. I told you, Don, I think the last script draft I read was version 86. It might have even been more than that. And what was really fun and also very challenging is we were trying to, A, show people that these crimes are still being committed, that Nuremberg didn't stop it, that the International Criminal Court didn't stop it. So we actually have live victim testimony from situations all over the world. We have North Korean victims. We have victims from the Congo, from Colombia, from Chad, from Iraq, ISIS victims, and one other that's escaping me. Oh, and the Holocaust, of course. Ben Fainer, local St. Louis native, gave us film footage right before he died. So we show how these victims have been affected. And what was tricky is you have to be very accurate, of course, in your portrayal of the individuals, of their situation. Everything has to be translated. So you're hearing the victims in their original language. The Korean woman is speaking Korean, and the victim from Chad is speaking a beautiful French, actually. We show clips of prosecutions because there have been prosecutions. Eichmann trial, very important. The Pinochet case, very important. Fujimura in Peru. So there have been many very important prosecutions. We talk about international criminal justice, and we have experts, all of whom I have to say donated their time. Nobody asked us for money. It was fantastic. So you have the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, who is featured in the film, speaking about the importance of crimes against humanity to her work. There's a judge from the International Criminal Court, Christine Vandenweingart. You have prosecutors. You have Ben Ferenz, the last living Nuremberg prosecutor who gave us footage. He's 98 years old. It's just a great film, and it's only 45 minutes, but it was hard.
We pack a lot. We only have a minute left, but you said there were issues of language and issues
Absolutely.
Of law that had to be worked out to put all of this together. What a monumental test that is. One final area. Again, time is very, very short. Why not just put it on the internet?
It is actually available. If you write to us, we'll give you a link. And we will have a short trailer available that anybody can see. The full film, there were a bunch of reasons why we didn't want it just on YouTube or elsewhere. Yeah. You do have to write to us to get the full film. People explain that to me, and I'm not quite sure I understood it. But that's what we've done so far.
Well, you've done a lot. We'll get all of that information on the Internet. Leila Sadat, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on all your hard work. I'll remind the audience that the International Institute presents Leila's film, Never Again Forging a Convention for Crimes Against Humanity, this evening at the International Institute. That's happening at 6 o'clock. You can register up until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.